China does see this as an attempt by the United States to work towards containing it.
Chinese and Russian missiles prompt a U.S. policy shift. It's Tuesday, October 23rd. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. You'll find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Australia apologizes for sexual abuse. Rohingya Hindus observe a festival. The bravery of Afghan women on stage. Roadside food and virtual city tours before and after war. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton met Monday with top Russian officials about President Donald Trump's announced intention to pull out of a key Cold War arms deal with Moscow. Bolton discussed the fate of the three-decade-old INF, or Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, with the Russian Security Council chief ahead of a meeting with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Bolton is set to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin Tuesday. President Donald Trump announced on Saturday the decision to pull out of the treaty, citing what he claimed was Russia's building and testing missiles that violate the 1987 treaty. In March, Navy Admiral Harry Harris, who was then commander of the U.S. Pacific Command, told the Senate Armed Services Committee that China was benefiting because of the United States' adherence to the INF. He was questioned by Senator Tom Cotton.
How many of China's land-based missile forces do you estimate have a range of 500 to 5,500 kilometers?
In an unclassified venue, Senator, over 90%. Over 90% fall in that range.
And how many missiles do you have that fall into that range?
I have none, sir.
You have none?
Right.
Why do you have none?
Because that range, 500 to 5,500 kilometers, is defined in the INF Treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Force Treaty, which prohibits nuclear and cruise missiles and ICBMs, or nuclear and conventional cruise and ICBMs, or ballistic missiles in that range. And we adhere to the INF Treaty religiously, as we should. It's a treaty that we signed on for. China is not a signatory to the treaty, so they're not obliged to follow that treaty, and we can't legitimately, in my opinion, criticize China for developing weapons that contravene the treaty because they did not sign on to it.
Because the only two parties to the treaty are Russia and the United States.
That's correct.
Could the inability to match China's missile force be reason enough for the United States to pull out of the INF? Ankit Panda of the Federation of American Scientists, an expert in missile defense and nuclear issues in Asia, tells VOA Asia's Ira Melman that is one of the reasons the pullout might take place.
The reason I find it unconvincing, or at least unconvincing so far without further debate, is because, first of all, it's not necessarily the case that the United States needs to mirror image Chinese capabilities to successfully deter China. I do care about deterring China, but I don't necessarily think that we need to have exactly the kind of ballistic and cruise missile arsenal that they do, in particular because the kind of geography we're dealing with in East Asia is quite different from the geography of Western Europe, where ground launch missiles in Central Europe and Western Europe played a critical role through the early 1980s in deterring the Soviet Union. In Asia, we're dealing with primarily a maritime domain where there are very few actual chunks of land in allied countries. Guam is probably the closest U.S. territory where these weapons could be deployed. But apart from that, looking at specific U.S. allies and partners, it's not clear to me that, A, the kind of territory that exists would be particularly useful for those kinds of deployments, and B, there's a complicated issue of allied politics here. You know, we think about a place like Okinawa, and we think about potential ballistic missile deployments there or cruise missile deployments there, even conventional weaponry. I'm not even talking about nuclear weaponry. It's not clear to me that allied populations would be willing to host U.S. Missiles on their soil.
Why is it that China is putting up such a vociferous complaint against pulling out of the treaty?
China does see this as an attempt by the United States to work towards containing it. The reason that China's arsenal looks the way it does is not entirely to do with the United States, although that's certainly a big part of it. China also borders India, where a lot of those INF range missiles that it deploys do play a role in deterring New Delhi. India is also a nuclear power in this context, so China does have concerns there. But otherwise, China's nuclear arsenal remains particularly lean, and the Chinese do see this as a play by the United States to effectively counter its fairly lean deployment. I think while we do see the Chinese protesting right now, I think in 5 to 10 years' time, if this does play out the way I think it will, and the United States will develop new INF range capabilities and deploy them in East Asia, I think we will see changes in China's own posture, potentially China building considerably a greater number of missiles and potentially even making some subtle changes to its nuclear doctrine.
Conjecture has it that what the Trump administration wants to do is what it has done in many other areas, and that is blow up. That's a bad use of terminology, but nevertheless, to blow up what exists and then rebuild. And that what he would like is a similar treaty to the INF, but one that includes China. Have you heard that? Is that a possibility?
That, I agree, would be the ideal solution, would be to bring China into the INF arrangement. That simply won't happen, given the investments that the Chinese have made. And this would not be a treaty discussion that they would have been a part of from the beginning. This is a 1987 agreement between the United States and the Soviet Union, and China at the time had no role or no consideration in the minds of the Soviet Union or the United States in negotiating the treaty. So while that would be ideal, I do think it's fairly unrealistic.
Defense advocates in Washington say the INF treaty keeps the United States from developing a new generation of weapons in a world that faces new global security challenges. Trump said, quote, "We'll have to develop those weapons unless Russia comes to us and China comes to us and they all come to us and say, let's really get smart and let's none of us develop those weapons." Mr. Trump went on to say, "But if Russia's doing it and China's doing it and we're adhering to the agreement, that's unacceptable." These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on VOANews.com. The Koreas and United Nations Command work toward disarming the DMZ. South China Sea Code of Conduct gains momentum as China moves to complete militarization. Philippines scrambles to fund undersea energy as import prices hit consumers. Taiwan closely monitored two U.S. warships path through Taiwan Strait. Maldives court frees opposition leader convicted of bribery. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, we invite you to stop by the VOANews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Australia's Prime Minister has delivered an historic national apology to all victims and survivors of institutional child sexual abuse. It follows a damning 5-year inquiry into abuse across churches, schools, and other public organizations, as we hear from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Prime Minister Scott Morrison has said he's sorry for one of the most shameful chapters in Australian history. A royal commission, Australia's highest form of inquiry, found that tens of thousands of children had been abused over many decades in orphanages, churches, schools and other institutions. Its report, published last year, said too often the victims were ignored and the perpetrators protected. Morrison told Parliament Monday that it was a national tragedy.
Silenced voices, muffled cries in the darkness, unacknowledged tears, the tyranny of invisible suffering, the never-heard pleas of tortured souls bewildered by an indifference to the unthinkable theft of their innocence. Today, Australia confronts a trauma, an abomination.
Survivors of abuse have welcomed Australia's official apology, but many stress that much more needs to be done to heal their scars, including a less bureaucratic system of compensation and changes to the law to punish those who conceal abuse. Victims are eligible to apply for payments of up to $106,000, although there are complaints the redress scheme is too slow. The Prime Minister also promised to set up a new national museum to raise awareness and understanding of the impacts of child sexual abuse. It will also memorialise victims' stories. Their accounts of childhood suffering are also open to the public on the Royal Commission's website. One survivor wrote of his continuing trauma. In 1978, a little boy started crying. In 2014, he still is. Following the Commission's five-year investigation, 2,500 cases of abuse were handed to Australian authorities, and scores of prosecutions are underway. In August, the Catholic Church in Australia formally rejected one of the inquiry's key recommendations that priests should be forced to report sexual abuse disclosed during confession. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, a mining accident in China's Shandong province leaves two dead and 18 people still trapped following the rescue of two miners. You can see much more on this story on VOA 60 online. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always happy to have you with us on VOA Asia. Bangladesh's Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina says there are more than 1 million Rohingya refugees living in Bangladesh. Among the Muslim-majority ethnic group, there are approximately 450 Hindus living in the city of Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh. VOA's Muazzim Hossein Shakil visited these Hindus as they were observing their first-ever Hindu festival called Durga Puja and filed this report, narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
With the help of the Bangladesh government, approximately 450 Rohingya Hindus celebrated their first-ever Durga Puja in Bangladesh. Durga Puja is a Hindu festival that marks the victory of the goddess Durga in a battle with an evil demon. According to the Rohingya Hindus, they have never been able to publicly celebrate Durga Puja due to the restrictions imposed on them by the Myanmar government.
I haven't performed Durga Puja for the last 10 years and I have never been to celebrate in front of Fatima. It is really great to celebrate in Bangladesh. I'm very happy.
We would celebrate at home privately without Fatima. We couldn't do it publicly.
Thousands of Bengali Hindus celebrated the colorful Durga Puja festival all across Bangladesh and in Cox's Bazar. Rohingya Hindus were also treated to a special ceremony orchestrated by the Bangladesh government. Local governments provided security and some local government officials attended the celebration.
Evil power pushes these Rohingyas from their own country. They are eager to go back because they're suffering in the camps. The government is trying to help them to return without any problems.
Rohingya Hindus are hopeful that one day they will be able to celebrate Durga Puja in their homeland freely. For Muazzam Hossein Shakil in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, this is Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
Coming up, the stage curtains open to display bravery. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia. Indonesia's president is deeply concerned about the killing of journalist Jamil Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, and wants a transparent investigation. Indonesian Foreign Minister Retno Marsudi made the comments. You can visit VOA Asia 60 online and VOA Asia Facebook for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Afghan women too many times have been seen by some as victims. Victims of domestic violence, cultural limitations, political restrictions, and more. Their voices often go unheard, but not in a play produced here in Washington, D.C., called Women of Troy, Voices from Afghanistan. It's a story of Afghan women's bravery and resilience told through music and poetry. Narration is by VOA's Sheila Nurai. She brings us more.
My name is Poseidon, God of antiquity.
The Kennedy Center for Performing Arts in Washington presented a limited run of Women of Troy, Voices from Afghanistan, a collaboration between Afghan and American artists.
I think the message is learning about Afghanistan, the many layers of the people, especially the women, goes very deep and very far back into history. And I hope everyone will get a much better understanding of Afghanistan.
Don't mock me! I feel things! I love, I hate!
Oh my, I've never known a god switch so quickly from love to hate!
It's a retelling of an anti-war play, Trojan Women, by the ancient Greek playwright Euripides. The twist? The Alliance for New Music Theatre sets the story in modern-day Afghanistan, dedicated to Afghan women. Music plays a crucial role in the play, with a unique combination of cello plus Afghanistan's national instrument, rabab, and the percussive tabla. Singer and actress Jennifer Lee spent 6 months in rehearsals and says she's formed a special bond with the character she plays.
I think it was just so wonderful because it shows the unity that women across the world, we share the same plight. And I think that's so great that I was able to really capture the character of Hecuba and capture the mood of the plight of Afghanistan women.
Choreographer Liza Ahmadi thinks now is the time for the world to see the true Afghan women.
We have roots of creativity, roots of all kinds of cultures and ethnicities inside of us. And right now, the way that Afghan women and Afghans in general are presented is in a very, very flat one image. And in fact, we're incredibly complex, incredibly intelligent society.
The play's co-author Yelda Bakhtash wanted to break any stereotypes held by Westerners about Afghan women. Bakhtash hopes that through these characters, a more realistic picture of Afghan women emerges.
The perception of Afghan women in the West is that they are weak and unable to deal with difficulties. But I decided to display a different view of Afghan women, and for this reason, I tried to write about characters with abilities, achievers in Afghan history.
Audience member Mariam Jalali said it was refreshing to see the portrayal of an Afghan woman by an American.
An American woman was playing an Afghan woman and showcasing a scene in the life of an Afghan woman. That was very interesting to see.
The message of this reboot of the Greek play written in 415 BC is that Afghan women have been an integral part of their own society, both brave and strong, much like the women of Troy. For Gila Nuri in Washington, D.C., this is Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
This news from VOA Asia: abandoned burial urns became a trend in Japan, the fastest aging country in the world, as care for the elderly becomes difficult in a changing nation. You can see more on VOA 60, and of course all the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, food here in the United States can be quite varied as you travel through different regions. In one West Virginia town, the food itself and how it became available might be considered very unusual. First, we're talking about delicacies such as spicy bear and deer stew, rich turtle soup, alligator gumbo, possum and elk. These main ingredients are roadkill, animals who were killed along the local highways by passing cars. Evgeny Barnov attended this event and tried some of the unique offerings. Anna Rice serves details.
Marland in West Virginia is home to about 1,000 residents and one famous cook-off, the roadkill cook-off. For more than 25 years, chefs and meat lovers have been flocking to the town to cook up or eat up black bear, possum, elk, snapping turtle, and even reptiles.
The name of our team is You Hit 'Em, We Spit 'Em, like on a spit to cook something. It's called Hillbilly Mardi Gras Alligator and Turtle Gumbo over Country Creamy Grits, or Creamy Country Grits.
We are making a predator prey chili with bear meat and venison, which is deer meat.
It's a neat place to try a new kind of food. I mean, you don't get alligator every day. You don't get bear every day.
But even the Roadkill Cook-Off's main cheerleader and organizer still has concerns about food safety and how the roadkill is handled.
Unless it's taken away, like, immediately within minutes after it's killed, if not, the meat gets poisoned because the sedatives go through the body. So once they're hit along the road, 5 minutes later, they're probably no good.
Roadkill aficionados point out that there are ways to ensure the meat is safe to eat. And they argue since the animals are dead, it's wasteful not to serve them up as food. Half of U.S. states have laws that allow people to pick up and cook animals hit and killed by vehicles.
We can't control the wildlife and keep it from getting hurt when we drive on the roads, but we try to make use of what we have.
But not all events at the festival are so controversial. Downtown Marlinton is blocked off for the day, and tourists can wander the main streets where vendors sell locally handcrafted items and an old-timey country fair is in full swing.
The Autumn Harvest Festival is one of those nice festivals where we get to celebrate the arts and crafts of our community.
And if it helps celebrate the rustic and sometimes rugged culture of West Virginia, it's a tradition the locals plan to continue. For Evgeny Baranov in Marlington, West Virginia, I'm Anna Rice, VOA News.
The Syrian government says the ancient city of Palmyra, gravely damaged by Islamic State militants, could reopen to the public next spring. But while restoration continues on the ground, one French tech startup is showing people how Palmyra and other cities affected by war once looked, how they look now, and how they might look after restoration. Kevin Enix explains.
This is the Syrian city of Aleppo, after it was damaged by fighting during the civil war. And this is the Al-Nouri Mosque in Mosul, Iraq, also damaged by fighting. And this is how it looked once upon a time, and perhaps could again. This imagery, courtesy of a small French startup called Iconum, is showing not only the devastation of some of the world's historic places, but also providing images of the same places undamaged by time and war.
De prise de vue, hein, des appareils photo, des drones. On prend des centaines.
We take hundreds of thousands of photos that we bring back to France to process using large computers, and these algorithms will automatically construct photorealistic 3D models, true copies of the real sites, but virtual.
To get those photos, the teams visit sites like this one in Palmyra, armed with cameras, then let their algorithms do the rest.
This 3D model that we're in the process of generating will help to make the general map of the land register, which will allow architects to see the city, which monuments we will be able to keep, and which we can restore, and which strategy we will adopt for the future reconstruction.
Some of the team's work is currently on display in Paris, and for many people, it's a sobering affair.
Sadness. I feel sadness because I visited Leptis Magna and Aleppo before the bombings, and it is gut-wrenching, really, because it was a very beautiful city, well-preserved, with a real life to it, and to see that is saddening.
Iconum has teamed up with the UN to help its efforts to preserve and restore places like Mosul, Aleppo, and Palmyra. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online on iTunes and SoundCloud. And, of course, we're streaming on VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. You can hear us the old-fashioned way, we sometimes say, on the radio. Helps Radio at Help University in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Thanks to everyone there who tuned in today. And our thanks always go to our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Thomas Blondet, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team that includes Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a terrific day.